Konnichiwa, you're listening to Jewels and Bullets, the UMI Discography Podcast, the show where a UMI fan and a UMI super fan discuss each of the band's records. I'm Tommy Waits, an Aussie writer and podcaster who's based out of Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm the UMI fan in the equation. My co-host and UMI super fan is Sydney Sider, John O'Duncan, the host of the Progressive Rugby League podcast, and general man about town, John O. How the bloody hell are ya?
I'm doing good, Tom. How are you? It's a good time to be alive. Last week, we were convicts. This week, we're dilettantes. You know, normally that kind of arc takes seasons. But just in a week, the richness of being a UMI fan. So good to be here.
Yeah, we're lucky boys. As Jono's mentioned today in episode 8, we're talking dilettantes from 2008. Before we dive in, to my regular disclaimer, I just quickly wanted to ask you, we teased this many episodes ago, but I shared my Tim Rogers meet cute story in Echo Park in Los Angeles many moons ago. What is your Tim Rogers meet and actually converse with story as opposed to standing awkwardly next to him at a bar?
Well, I've got a Tim Rogers meet story, an Andy and Rusty meet story, and a Davey meet story. So maybe I'll just do one of those. Which one? I'll let you choose, basically. Would you like the Tim?
Let's have the Tim and then maybe the other boys at the end of the ep if we've got time.
Yeah, sure, sure. Well, the Tim story is a pretty standard fan interaction. I was overly keen before a gig once at the Gaelic Club in Surrey Hills. I think it must have been mid-2000s or maybe early 2000s. And I was standing there waiting for a friend, I think, maybe 6:30, 7 p.m. And the band came out after doing a sound check and that looked like they were going for somewhere to eat. So all four of them came out and, you know, obviously I froze. But, you know, something inside me said, come on, Jono. This is your time to shine. So I just started walking alongside them awkwardly and then sort of just started saying stuff to Tim, who was like third in. So it was kind of awkward for the others. And then Tim stopped and he was extremely nice. And sort of I said, you know, big fan, blah, blah, blah. And he gave me a big hug and we sort of talked for maybe a minute and he was telling us that, you know, they'd been playing shit lately, but hoping for a good show that night. And yeah, and then we, you know, hugged it out and he went off on his way and I was super happy and you know, told all my friends and that was about it really. I think I would have been early 20s, so it would have been pretty early in my UMI fandom, maybe 4 or 5 years into it. So like that was my sweet spot and a really good experience and good interaction.
Nice one. And how let's get back to our favorite concept, authenticity. How did you feel, because I'm curious, especially with kind of like cult heroes like Rogers, he must get stopped like once or twice a day, I'm imagining, for the last 25 years.
Yeah.
Did you feel like it was making any positive impact on him, or was it all business? Was it just like,
good question.
I've got to get through this? Yeah, like I guess, did you overanalyze it that much, or was it such a moment for you that you can't really decipher what his emotional impact, if any, was?
Yeah, I have overanalyzed it, of course, and I think he did all the right. He did all the right things, you know, made all the right sounds, good eye contact, you know, a hug or two, which was very exciting, and you know, seemed genuinely engaged. Was asking me questions, but like I was so warped that I was giving nothing in return. So like he was in the end doing all the hard work, which was not fair. I should have been doing the hard work. I should have at least met him halfway, but I'm just there going, yep, no. So, you know, he's obviously done that before. And yeah, whether he was, you know, absolutely engaged or just was just being nice, doesn't really matter. If you're not in the mood and you're just being nice, then that's a good sign as well. I'm happy with that. And it would be understandable if you're not in the mood to have an interaction. So I took the just being nice. And if there was anything more than that, then that's a bonus.
100%. Yeah, you'd imagine that like with a celebrity in the early phases of their celebrity, if a fan comes up to them and engages, they'd perhaps be a little, you know, they'd be kind of like starstruck in that, like, oh, someone thinks I'm a star, and perhaps a little too eager to to continue. The fans like, oh, no, I wanted a 90-second interaction. I don't want to come with, like, so it's a weird, it must be a weird arc for a celebrity where there's that beginning phases where even the most kind of solemn, introverted celebrity must feel a sense of gratification and excitement to be recognized and accosted. But then it could go, for if you've been a celebrity for decades, then it could go way the other direction where you just like shut down any attempted interaction whatsoever. So you'd always hope that your heroes are somewhere in the sweet spot, especially if you've worked up the courage to connect with them directly. So seems like you got a good deal with Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, you're right. I think it would be a bit like that when you first start out. People might be saying you're selling records and stuff, but that first couple of times when people actually come up to you and say, I'm a huge fan of what you're doing, what you're creating, that must be like, oh, geez. And you'd feel the enormous sense of gratitude. But yeah, I guess like we're talking about later, that there would be a diminishing returns element to it where there's less incremental buzz from that. And eventually it'd be like, oh, please leave me alone. I just want to do my own thing. So yeah. But I guess they're probably not at that level of celebrity where they got to that point where it's just like, leave me alone. So all my interactions, which are just one each with each of the band members, have been very nice.
Good to hear. Just a heads up, this is perhaps getting into the man behind the Wizard of Oz curtain territory, but I've lost my visual Jono. So I can still hear you loud and clear, but the video's frozen on your beautiful face. So if I'm not making eye contact if I'm behaving extra autistic this over the next 10 minutes, is because your video is froze, but I'm still here loud and clear. And but just a heads up if the eye contact's a bit wonky.
I can see my frozen face. I'm looking off into the distance. It's not the worst angle, but I'm not a huge fan of that look, but let's go with it.
It's got kind of like a 17th century painting type of vibe, you know, like they always kind of look a bit disturbed looking out a window type of. So I personally think it's pretty good. If it's going to freeze on any facial expression, I think you've done pretty well. But all right, so jumping into our disclaimer, before we get stuck into dilettantes, quick disclaimer, myself and Jono are in no way affiliated to UMI. We're just two fans talking music for the love of the game. If you've found this show, there's a good chance you're already familiar with the group known as UMI. But if not, listen to their records, go to their shows, send them all your money and love. They bloody deserve it. Jono, you seem like a man who harbors a secret fantasy that involves moving to fentanyl-ravaged middle America, getting admitted to the bar, then becoming a Saul Goodman-esque litigator who helps free and brave Yankees win millions after they slip in the mall shortly after acquiring supersized Slurpees. How do you think this disclaimer holds up from a legal perspective?
Are you a dreamweaver, Tom? Like, how do you sort of get into my mind and read what's going on there in the middle of the night?
You're onto me.
Look, at the crux of it, let's just say I do the worrying for both of us. I think that's how I'll describe it. I think we're fine.
Great. Yeah, no, we're good. All right, so format for the show will be the same as it always is. We'll kick things off with some discussion about what led up to the recording and release of Dilettantes. Then we'll go through the record track by track. Finally, when the dust is settled, we'll talk about what happened after the album dropped. We'll give our respective gold, silver, bronze medals for the tunes, our fave three tunes on the record. And if we've got time, we'll go through Jono's meet cute stories from the other lads in the band. But to kick things off, a dilettante is a person who cultivates an area of interest, such as the arts, without real commitment or knowledge, aka a wealthy literary dilettante. So that's the album title. Jono, how do you think this kind of fits in with where we've come from off the back of the last LP, Convicts?
Yeah, good question, Tom. Look, a a bit of housekeeping maybe from the last episode that will flow nicely into dilettantes. So we rattled on a lot, and rightly so, last episode about the amazing sound produced on Convicts. So it was remiss of us not to mention that Convicts was produced by Greg Wales, is an Aussie producer, worked around the Oz music traps a fair bit from the 90s onwards, spending a bit of time at Triple J too. He's a master of recording and mixing touring bands, and I think he's still at Triple J in some capacity. Now, Greg Wales is also a producer on Dilettantes. Okay, so Convicts was a triumph, you know, rip-roaring, searing set. So with Greg Wales back on board, more of the same, right? Friends, come on. This is album number 8 now. History has shown us that to this point, you and I have never gone for the same sound or vibe 2 albums in a row. And it's often a stark departure from the last. Think of the transitions from the raucousness of Sound as Ever to the pep of Hi-Fi Way to the sprawl of Ali Daly to the grease of Number 4 to the sheen of Dress Me Slowly to the space of Deliverance to the racket of Convicts. And so, you know, just like after a sunny day, you expect the sunshine to come again after the next day, even though it often rains the next day. People are probably expecting another Convicts-esque tour de force. But no, where Convicts grabs you by the scruff of the neck, Dilettantes kisses you on the neck. Dilettantes gives you nuance where Convicts slaps you across the face with a wet fish. Dilettantes is a beautiful and varied set of tunes. The eyes are open a little wider. The blinkers that sometimes accompany tough times have been loosened. And so with Dilettantes, there are still scars visible from the wounds that are so evident in Convicts, but there are also a few more surprises, like being taken from the front line with the French Foreign Legion to the clothesline in the suburban backyard. And again, this is the beauty of doing this pod with you, Tom. I haven't listened to Dilettantes properly as an album for too long, years probably. But I have again over the last week, and you know, I'm grateful. There are elements of darkness, but also of adventure and fun. I found it hard to pin down a thematic thread, and musically it's similarly varied. I guess rich is a word that comes to mind, but yeah, one thing is for sure and certain. It sounds nothing like Convicts. If Convicts is the sound of the garage, as we discussed last week, maybe Dilettantes is the sound of the loft. And yeah, incidentally, that sound won Greg Wales an ARIA for Engineer of the Year. So yeah, I do wonder if the title Dilettantes was chosen purposefully as a bit of a shortcut to explain the change in sound, kind of like anticipating the questions such as, you know, Convicts sounds like Convicts, but this doesn't sound like Convicts. Why? The band are kind of saying, you know, we know you like Convicts, you know, you framed us as being back. But that's just one side of us. We're also enthusiastic about a lot of things. And I guess, yeah, that definition that you mentioned comes in handy about cultivating an area of interest without real commitment or knowledge. And calling it Dilettantes is, I guess, a self-deprecating way of saying, hey, we wanted to do something a bit different with a bit more breadth. Leave us alone. So it's another beauty to get stuck into. Yeah, I guess I tell friends sometimes about this pod and they look it up and go, geez, 90 minutes. And I say, honestly, we could go for 3 hours. But we know, you know, people have got to get on with their days. So we'll try to keep it as tight as we can. But yeah, Dilettantes. Or as I thought it was pronounced when I first saw the word, Dilettantes.
Oh, Dilettantes.
I've never seen the word before Dilettantes. So it was an educational experience too.
Yeah, I would just echo your sentiment in terms of not listening to this record for quite a while. And yeah, I guess this is probably the right time to kind of slot in a little confession here. These are my confessions. Because as I mentioned last week, Convicts is perhaps the most kind of like personally important You and My record for me, just in terms of the album coming out and aligning with what was happening in my life at the time and just listening to it a ton when it was fresh. And so it makes that big imprint on your life when a album does that. With Dilettantes, I moved from Perth over to Sydney when it came out. And it was one of those records where at the time my life was a bit too busy to kind of sink my teeth into. And I guess from the bit I heard when it came out, it didn't sink my teeth into, it didn't sink its teeth into me either. Mm. And I always put it to the side thinking it's probably great. I just didn't have the time to get around to it. One day I'll get the chance to get around to it. And I have to, because in prior episodes, I feel like when there has been a track I've come across on an album which hasn't really hit me in the right spot, the general kind of vibe of the record has kind of got it over the line for me. Mm-hmm, and and I've seen it within the bigger picture. This record still didn't get me this time around. So, and I want to be very clear in that there's still great moments. There's still tunes I like, but I was definitely hoping for more. I was hoping for the, you know, the 15 plus years that have passed, well, about 15 years from now to when it was released, that I would have, I guess it would have grown on me a little bit more. And and so I want to just take the listener back to my kind of perhaps original confession on this pod was that 2002, 2003, whenever it was, the fateful Christmas when I asked for the cream and the crock, the You Are My Best Of, my first attempt at becoming a You Are My fan didn't really latch, didn't really take hold either. And so I guess what I'm curious about in this pod as we go through the tracks is that you're probably not going to be able to do it over the course of this pod, but I'm very curious to get your thoughts because I know where Jono stands on all things You Are My. You're going to be able to shine the brightest, you know, you're going to be able to illuminate the kind of the best things about each track. So I'm curious to kind of bounce ideas off you and get your impressions on each album, track of the album. Mm. And then in 5 years time, it's going to be interesting to get me to go back to these songs once again, much like with the cream and the crock. When I went back 5 years later, I was like, how did I overlook this the first time around? So that's my confession in terms of Dilettantes. I was hoping for more over the last week with the re-listen. Didn't quite get me there.
Well, I mean, there's no need for a confession. The honesty is wonderful, and thank you. Well, I would say that for me, interestingly, you know, when we prepare for this pod, you know, you listen to the record, you know, a few times, handful of times, and then by the time we get to recording, it's like, okay, I feel like I'm done with this record for now. Let's move on to the next. But then we do the recording, and then I'm like, oh, I wouldn't mind listening to the record again. I kind of feel like listening to the record, I'm a bit buzzed from our chat. And then revisit. So yeah, it might be that's how it works out. But it's also okay if it doesn't grab you. You know, that's the nature of music fandom, I guess.
Yeah, but I was actually I was gonna go in and say like, oh no, just say you loved it on the re-listen. I was like, what am I doing? Just be fucking honest. Jono will understand. but I think that's the that's kind of my thinking here is that I love so many of the UMI records and if their next album, for example, was voted universally the worst album of all time, I would still consider them one of my favorite bands ever.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of tenure that I believe they have. And so kind of when I recontextualized it in my head, I was like, dude, you, there's not someone watching over you, at least I don't believe there is, that's kind of like grading you, your internal impressions. You're allowed to kind of not feel as much for this record versus another one. So that's that's my confession, and it's kind of fitting the video isn't working here because I feel like you're the father, and you're just gonna give me some Hail Marys to do once I get home, and I'll be fine. So
yeah, maybe off mic, but you're probably reflective of a lot of fans who are You Are My fans or You Are My adjacent fans who probably got into them at some point through a rockin' record of like Hi-Fi Way or Convicts, and then Dilettantes comes out and it's different, right? So you're kind of hoping for maybe more of the same or something along the lines of what got you so pumped through Convicts, and then you know you get this more, I guess, nuanced record that doesn't have the same directness And I imagine your experience would be quite common for you and my fans, even those who like dilettantes are just like, I guess it's good, but I'll probably listen to Convicts. So yeah, I totally understand.
That was definitely, I think, my impression at the time, where I was like, well, it was a quieter record when it came out. And so, yeah, I was like, well, I'm sure once I have the time to get back to this, I'll appreciate it for what it was. And it was good to sink my teeth in and actually go a little deeper this time, but didn't, as I said before, didn't get to where I was hoping it would, but we can dive into that. Yeah. So let's get into track one, the Please Buy Me Dinner Before You Say titular track, Dilettantes. Jono, take us away.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure my first taste of dilettantes was at a solo gig of Tim's at the Annandale Hotel. It must have been the first half of 2008, so before Dilettantes was released later that year. So something like a Wednesday night, jam-packed, and Tim comes out to big applause and looking a bit worse for wear, to be honest. And my memory, while probably flawed, informs me that the first thing he says to the audience is something like, "This show tonight is a benefit gig for my landlord," you know, cue raucous laughter, you know, good line. Anyway, fantastic show, which I think started with Dilettantes, which again, if memory serves, is a bit of a tribute to Jackie Orzarski, the Sydney jazz icon, who contributed so well to Ali Daly and Dress Me Slowly, and who passed away in early 2008. So a couple of months before this gig, I guess. And that night, Tim relayed a story of the last time he saw Jackie, I think at an airport. They had a nice chat, and then Jackie mentioned that he still hadn't been paid for the Dress Me Slowly sessions, and Tim said that he'd follow up with the management or the record company or something. But yeah, I guess not long after that, he was gone, and so that's my memory from that story. So yeah, it felt like Tim was carrying around some real sadness from Jackie's passing at that gig. But the song itself, whoever it's about, and I'm pretty sure it is about Jackie, to me, it has a similar vibe to Vandalism from Number 4, kind of about observing a character that just seems to have it all worked out, you know, a person that people are magnetized to and want to orbit around, and meanwhile, Tim's overdressed and missed the point. You know, you would have loved the guy, eyes like windows into a 37-letter Dr. Seuss invention. And then there's earned wisdom too, you know, existing just for what you want can leave you amiss of the calamities you need. You know, a lot of great liners in this tune. And musically, you know, the song is so lush too. There's a beautiful string accompaniment, acoustic guitar on point, and great claps, a clapping masterclass. You know, you and I are great at using clapping to enhance a song, but I reckon this might be their best clapping moment through the middle eight, or whatever it's called, of this song. So for me, so much to love about this song. And obviously, as we mentioned last episode, an enormous departure from Thank God I Hit the Bottom at Convicts. So once again, a bit of a 180 in terms of vibe from album to album.
Yeah, well, it's and I think that another crucial thing the track one does, like it does on many records, is it sets up track two as it kind of as it transitions into Disappearing. And a couple of things jumped out at me. The acoustic guitar at the beginning, it's got a really I'd call it a Colin Hay intro, you know, the geezer from Men at Work, when he does his solo stuff. It's you know, the stripped back acoustic guitar front and center, I'm overdressed and missed the mark line jumped out at me based on reading Detours and Roger's talking about like over feeling the need to kind of overdress in pretty much every situation. I feel like this is where it gets into, I think it's a good opening track choice, because the theme of the record, I was trying to pin it down, and this maybe ties into why it didn't work with me at the time, but I feel like after the kind of Convicts, you know, a relationship dissolution and, you know, life being chaotic, but raucous and raw, but kind of finding almost the fun within that sense of rebirth. I think Dilettantes is kind of like the depression and just kind of alcoholism that perhaps comes with it. And that's kind of, there's a sense of kind of like sadness throughout the record that I seem to pick up on, that really kind of conveyed through the recording of Tim's voice and I believe his delivery as well. Which, yeah, I think is kind of like, that's the record they were trying to make, and therefore I think it's a good decision. And, you know, I believe I've referenced him on this podcast before. There's a comedian I like, American guy called Kurt Metzger. He made a good point about drug movies. He said, Requiem for a Dream is the only drug movie I've ever seen that didn't make me want to take drugs. You think about other infamous drug movies such as Trainspotting, Blow, Wolf of Wall Street, they glamorize drugs. You know, they'll maybe show a crash and a burn, but you still kind of want to be hanging out with Jordan Belfort, even though he's a coked up douchebag. And likewise with the lads in Trainspotting jamming dirty needles into their arms, there's kind of like a fun aspect to it. So when I think of kind of like the almost like early midlife crisis that the themes that are getting discussed on Convicts on Dilettantes, Convicts is the fun version of that, whereas Dilettantes seems to be kind of like the more reality based somber, sad, lonely, you know, troubles that come with losing friends and being alone and struggling with drink and drugs and et cetera. So a long way of saying, I think that that they've definitely gone for the Requiem of a Dream angle, where it's kind of like, let's talk about this honestly and not glamorize things. Whereas Convicts, I think, was a bit more fun and you could get lost in the chaos.
You might be right. I think also, though, we'll find as we go through the tracks that there are elements of hope and fun within this. Because, I think it is true that the first couple of songs do imprint an impression on you about what the album's about. So when you think about an album, I'm going to listen to X album, you know, Dilettantes, you do think, oh yeah, it's that kind of like, you think of the first couple of tracks, Dilettantes into Disappearing, and it is somber and quite dark. And that's the same as when I think about all records, really. Like, I'm thinking about, in terms of the mood, the first couple of tracks, and that's really influential in how I see the record. But I reckon, and we'll see how we go, I reckon we'll find some little gems of hope and fun and humor. So let's see how we go, I reckon.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, let's go into track two, Disappearing. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, what an amazing song. When I mentioned the word nuance to describe this album, this is one of the songs that immediately comes to mind. I think in a way there's an element of, you know, reaction to the feeling of being less relevant and compounded by the wear and tear of domestic life. You know, it's kind of a sense of, you know, maybe you'd understand me more, or maybe it'd make more sense to you all if I wasn't around. You know, the lines, check the insurance, the bills and the loan, the numbers will add up and my stock will grow. And thinking about it, you know, sometimes if you're of a certain mindset on a certain day, it really does feel like there's a fine line between pushing on and disappearing, you know, to, as the line goes, to disappear complete and not leave a stink. It's just not as tough as you think. And musically, it's really interesting too. Andy Kent does some great work on the bass. I think Tim's guitar hits a really cool tone. But it is a fairly dark song and tough subject matter. Similar, I guess, we were talking last week with My Own Hand. Yeah, along those lines. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, for me, I recall, you know, the opener of Deliverance, I said that, you know, surely you and I have got to have some type of following in the trucker community. I would say this is definitely fits into their trucker rock catalog, where, you can just imagine kind of like a working class guy. I can picture the music video if I could do this. It's, you know, kind of like a maybe a regional town and just kind of working class people waking up at the crack of dawn and getting on, you know, the minutiae of Australian life that I guess companies like to advertise when they create, but they like to glamorize when they do adverts in between the footy or the NRL. But I don't know. I just feel like it's kind of the, like it just almost the little parts of your daily existence that no one else sees, which some days you do without thinking, other days are a real fucking struggle. And just in terms of the way the song has been put together, Tim's vocals are very like, they're kind of like muddled right in the mix. And so I think that I like to think that that's kind of on purpose here in that it's meant to be, it kind of adds, it's kind of a dreary, gloomy type of vibe. And also if you were going to go back a few records, maybe number four record or Deliverance or something, you'd imagine towards the end of the song, you could imagine the kind of thudding beat would maybe explode or do something different. Whereas all you really get at the end of this song is the vocals go up an octave, I think, but everything else is consistent and it just kind of keeps thudding along. So once again, kind of like with the opener, do you want the Requiem for a Dream or do you want the kind of the fun? And I think, again, they've kept it on brand for the kind of dark subject matter of the record with this track. But I imagine if I was a trucker, this would be, and I was having Mrs. Problems and I had a fucking long haul stretch ahead of me, I'd throw this one on 11 and hit the open road at 4 a.m. and it would sound pretty fucking good.
No, I agree, and I think there's something to what you said about the vocal in the mix. I guess with the subject matter, it wouldn't make sense to have it too far forward in the mix, like with you saying, you know, it could disappear at any moment if I really wanted to. It's not that hard, so to sort of announce that, you know, really directly would just be weird. So it kind of does make sense to be kind of muffled, and you're kind of sort of saying it to yourself really, rather than to anyone else. So yeah, interesting one.
All right, track three. How do we say in this? Be You Guest or Bo Guest or Bo Guest A?
Bo, is it Bo? I thought it was Bo Guest or Bo Guest is what I would say. But Tommy, you're a man of words and a fan of film. You know, have you consumed Bo Guest in either form, book or film? Are you aware of its origins, and have you consumed this quite famous adventure novel?
No, I have not. No, I have not. Cool. Yeah.
It is.
It kind of leaves it very open. I've obviously seen the UMI music video for this tune, and I've done a cursory Google, but I have not consumed the original content.
Yeah, so apparently it's a book by adventure novelist P.C. Wren about three brothers who enlist separately in the French Foreign Legion following the theft of a valuable family jewel from a country house of a relative. So, you know, I guess this song is essentially loosely about this book/film. I don't think there's too much subtext. And like you say, the film clip, I think, confirms that, but I'm not 100% sure. I remember this song didn't immediately hit me when I first heard it, but I remember you talking to me about this when we worked together. I think you told me that you and or your mates really rated this tune, which made me kind of listen to it again with different ears. You know, there must be something in it if the youth are into it. I reckon a nuanced tune, I reckon. I think Bo Geste or whatever, however you pronounce it, means beautiful gesture in French.
Yeah, and I'm just on the Wikipedia here, and it's the Michael Bo Guest. So yeah, maybe it is Bo, as in like Bo of the Ball, how Australians would pronounce Bo. Anyway, I like this tune a lot, and a few episodes ago, I think I recalled a experience I had when I was watching Channel V back in the day. Friends or Rom were fans were booing the Waikiki fans, and then the boys from Frenzel, Jay and the Doctor, were getting interviewed by Osher Gunsberg, formerly Andrew G, and they said, sorry that happened to Waikiki, but we just have no respect for adult contemporary music. And I was like, I like that sentiment. I'm going to share the same thoughts towards adult contemporary, as in it's not my thing. Lo and behold, a couple of weeks ago, Noel Gallagher released a new track. And another confession, I was a huge Oasis fan growing up. For the last 15 years since the Gallagher brothers have been putting out their solo work, I've been very much in the hate listen camp, where I like to see what they're up to, but I just don't think they're ever going to – they're better together. And if I had to pick a preference, it would probably be Noel, because he writes his own songs. But I found their kind of solo output a little cheesy and kind of on the nose. But I've liked to follow along, shamefully, I'd say it's verged on hate listening. But Noel Gallagher's recent track, it's called Pretty Boy. It's actually decent. I really like the production on it. Johnny Marr from The Smiths plays lead guitar on it. So it's actually it's ticking some boxes. And then lo and behold, I checked on my Apple Music, my music choice of player on my smartphone device, and it just jumped out at me. The genre that they had assigned it, I'm not sure if Noel G did this himself or Apple Music, that was adult alternative. And whoa. I was like, what? This is worlds colliding. I grew up as a proud alternative rock man, and I was against adult contemporary. Seems like things are morphing and merging, and I'm less judgmental than I used to be. And I was like, you know what, this track 3, I would almost call it adult alternative. That's where I'd slot it in, because it's definitely got a softer, poppier sound compared to the first two tracks on this record. And I do recall when this song came out, this was definitely the standout tune that me and my friends we liked the best at the time. And I honestly think it comes down to the lyrics. Like, there's so many good little lyrics in here. Nothing agrees like a guest. You ain't easy. Yes, nothing succeeds like excess. Yeah, I'm in, money down, you're the best. So I think there's lots, it kind of seems to be, there's lots of kind of, I don't know. I was in Colombia a few months ago. I just went drinking by myself in this little town in Envigado. All these kind of like low-ranking gangsters in this little neighborhood. I was just watching the world go by, sipping my aguardiente and feeling kind of exotic, because I was in a fucking foreign land, didn't know what was going on. And this song was kind of rolling through my head. And I also like in the song when the kind of the run on phrasing of the verse, when it's the where typically in a song you take a breath between kind of lines there, but it seems, and what I, that effect to me, it almost sounds like, you know, when you're talking to someone and they get fired up about something and then they do an accidental rant where they didn't plan the rant. It wasn't there, but they're just like, and another thing, blah, 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 blah. And so for me, I think
they're not breathing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that a similar effect is employed in this tune. And yeah, I think it's kind of romantic. It seemed exotic. And I wonder if Schweppes, just a little more bite, considered a lawsuit, considering effects they have at the beginning. But the UMI retort would definitely be, hey, fellas, we did it first in Doug Sam. They've got a precedent there for that. They haven't nabbed that straight from Schweppes. So anyway, that's my track 3 rant done.
And the it's the delivery on "you're the best" is like cool as well. Like, I like, as a bit of a game I play with myself, I like to insert "you and my" lyrics into my daily conversations that no one knows, because no one knows "you and my" like I do. So, like, no one will notice when I do it. But, like, this is an example of when someone does a favor for me at work or something, I'll be like, "you're the best." And they'll just, you know, go on with their daily lives. But for me, that's like a tick. Woo! But yeah,
definitely. Yeah. I said before, no one's watching with this type of stuff, but I like to think sometimes they are. That's not just Jono's joke. That's the gods are watching, going, "Yep, you and my fan did a good you and my joke." Full marks for effort.
Exactly. Chalk it up.
Cool. Well, that's track three. Moving on to track four, Frightfully Modern. Jono, take us away.
This is a great tune. Not really sure what it's about, but lyrically articulate and interesting and a nice build up to the chorus. You ain't seen the best of us yet, which I guess is what it's about. You know, it's a good stretching of the limbs number in relation to the rest of the start of this album. I remember the North Melbourne Kangaroos, you might be interested, Tom, Tim's AFL team, using this tune in their ads to sell memberships for what would have been the 2009 season. You know, you ain't seen the best of us yet. That makes sense. Now, I checked their ladder position for that season to see how truthful that advertising was in hindsight, you know, seeing if they did improve between 2008 and 2009. And, you know, you ain't seen the best of us yet. And, you know, is it truthful advertising? Unfortunately, the Kangaroos dropped from 7th place on the ladder in 2008 to 13th place in 2009. So I'm not sure if this was retrospectively reported to the Advertising Standards Bureau, but the reality was Kangaroo supporters had seen the best of their team at that point. So, but yeah, slightly sharper tone to the guitars here, a nice transition into a rock and chorus. You feel the momentum building with this song. Yeah. What are your thoughts, mate?
Yeah. Well, I guess my initial thought was that I think the UMI boys do a great job generally with the album sequencing, but I guess I was thinking that this one, either track four or track five, should have perhaps come in a track earlier.
Oh, yeah.
to fire things up a bit more, and add a little bit more irreverence a little earlier, then go into Bio Geste. So that was kind of my initial thought, is that the perhaps could have come a little earlier. It seems to kind of like almost have like a slightly throwback hi-fi way sound, maybe. I don't know, like I'm just trying to think about past records, like what's similar. And yeah, just the other thing that jumps out at me is that I'm definitely not the most well-read person in the world, but it seems like Tim Rogers, he's just spilling over with weird and wonderful little references. Like, I think there's a line in this song from the Book of Deuteronomy to the Habsburg monarchy, which, if you're not familiar, there's the Habsburg, which is this like a royal family, and they became known for the Habsburg jaw, because they were just so inbred, they started getting really weird fucking faces. They were part of the Holy Roman Empire. I only heard about them like last year, and like history, I like history, so I was reading about them and I was like, Jesus Christ, Tim knows about them as well. So he's got an ability to kind of weave these things in. And I remember
Deuteronomy is from the Bible, right? I think.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So I've got no idea what the lyric means, but it's interesting. And you know, I've got this memory of if you recall the band from Queensland, the Greats, 1920. That when they, because they were just kids when they first came out, when they first started releasing songs, and they had an interview, they were like, "Yeah, we just write about things that we've seen in movies because we're so young, we haven't had many life experiences yet. And so that's what we write about." And I was like, I remember respecting that at the time, because I was like, yeah, who wants to hear about your high school breakup? Let's, you know, write about a Tarantino movie or something. It might be more interesting. But I've always kind of, it then becomes, as the songwriter gets older, if they're talking about esoteric references outside of their own experience, I don't know, it's kind of like, I'm happy if the greats are writing about a Tarantino movie. I don't necessarily want a 38-year-old Tim Rogers to do that, but he's got a great knack, or just a curious mind, where he can take these kind of like very you know, he can slip in historical and religious references into songs about completely other stuff. So I've always appreciated that. Probably the only downside is that on this record, his delivery and his and the mix of the vocal makes it really difficult to pick up a lot of the lyrics. So and as we discussed over the past week, there's not many lyrics out there on the internets for this record. So that adds to the mystery of the whole thing.
Yeah, I would say, like, to, not that it's a criticism, but they obviously are going for a certain sound and a vibe on this album. But this is one song, and maybe we could sort of say the same for Giving Up and Getting Fat, where it could really explode. You know, in this chorus, you ain't seen the best of us yet, and it does kind of like ramp up and stuff. But like, there's a part of me that's like, put on the triple, double, quadruple overdrive pedal, you know, like let's really, but like, it would probably sound shit, right? So, you know, it sounds great as a song in itself, but there's a sense of really wanting, as a listener, to really want to rock out at that time, and there is a restraint to it. I think it's purposeful because of the vibe they're going for, but yeah, this is a song, and yeah, track 8, Giving Up and Getting Fat, where I think, oh yeah, you know, maybe if they're on another album, it'd be like and a different vibe, it'd be perhaps a bit more getting into the thick of the rock and action when it gets to the crescendo.
For sure. All right, track 5, Wankers.
Tom, I think this song is aimed at the set who think the younger generations just aren't tough enough and that we're cultivating a society of wusses. I guess it's, you know, the commercial talkback radio set, maybe. I like the first couple of lines. You know, there are assholes who don't automatically smile at kids as if they'd be denying them a slipshod education if they did. To think that a simple affirmation or praise is going to buckle up the steely spine you need these days. You know, a bit of social commentary, I guess, taking a dig at parts of the older generations who want kids to suffer like they did. You know, saying without any irony, it didn't do me any harm. And, you know, maybe not. But either way, once again, lyrics reflecting wisdom earned and lessons learned. You know, when you're stuck between what is or what could be, do you slip in the cracks? When the heart grows a mind, the living is divine. You know, it's some good one-liners in it. And a bit of a glam rock feel, I guess, to it.
I wrote down military rock. It's kind of like glam crossed with, the boys on the barracks. Whipped out the electric guitars and the eyeshadow and said, let's have a party. And I like the it occurred to me, I think, several weeks after I finished Detours, but Detours kicks off with Rogers having kind of like an unsavory reaction with like a middle-aged older cab driver in Brisbane, I believe, where he's talking about how the young kids are like, oh, they've gentrified this area, they've fucking ruined it. And then but it's bookended, the end of Detours, Rogers talks about a similar unsavory encounter he had, but with a young hipster in Melbourne who came up to him at a bar and said, like, yeah, you're in a band, what do you stand for, man? And basically saying, oh, you just being a rocker without having kind of like a social cause to prop you up is kind of redundant. But it just occurred to me. I was like, yeah, you can be a wanker at any age. And it aligns with my cynicism where I see no difference in the generations. I think that the technology is different, the haircuts are different, but human nature is the same. And it just depends when you get spat out.
And the generation gaps are the same as well. Like there's generation gaps all the way down, and our generation, you know, kind of despises the generations above, and they despise us, and they think the world's going to shit because of us, and we think they're annoying and outdated, and it's just probably the same old thing century after century.
100%. And you know, the criticisms we throw on younger or older people is sometimes like a political or economic sentiment. Young people are lazy, old people are hoarding all the money. But I think if we cut the bullshit, It's we can't get past our own kind of like vanity. We're jealous of the younger people because they're trimmer. They've got more of their hair, and there's less wrinkles around their eyes.
Yeah.
And the older ones, we're like, oh yeah, you've got more money because you did some clever negative gearing in the early 90s. But at least I can do my 45, whatever the F45 for five times a week, and you're too old for that. So I think we can't. That's really at the forefront of everyone's brains, but that's a separate pod. I'm on my own bullshit here. So, but yeah, I guess just a final thought about Wankers. I thought that this kind of like was one track where I was like, oh, maybe the first one on this album where it was like really built for the live show. I would have liked to have seen this live, but similar to maybe like some of the songs off Number Four record, where I just don't think the production isn't quite right for this, and I can't put my finger on what it is, but yeah, I want it to explode. I want it to be more bombastic and kind of in your face, but it's not quite there for me. But yeah, maybe would have been one of those like similar to tracks off Number Four where a lot of people had gripes with the recordings, but then you see the same songs live and they seem to kind of be firing on all cylinders. So maybe this would be similar category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good tune. All right. Good tune. But yeah, I tend to agree. It makes me think where sequencing comes into it, as you discussed before, like if this was sequenced differently, maybe we'll chat about this at the end. Like it could have given off a different vibe to the album and then a different appreciation to the song. So I'm just trying to think as we're going through the songs, what if this was the first track? Or yeah, because I think Dilettantes and Disappearing really do dominate the vibe of the record. So yeah, anyway, interesting one to think about as we go along.
Yeah, you're right, because I think, you know, like by the time you get to four or five, you've settled in a little. So if these ones, four or five, was a bit earlier, then maybe they'd punch you in the face a bit more. So
yeah.
Track six, The Big Wheel, a bit of riffage in this one.
Look, once again, don't really know what this song's about, but the start of the song is referenced in Detours. So the song starts, "It was in a Hamburg nightclub where I got compared to that Sean Penn again. I took it as flattery. Sure, I knew what she meant. Yeah, the Falcon and the Snowman. Yeah. And there is an excerpt from the book. So I'm going to read if that's okay with you, Tom.
Go for it.
Okay, so it's near the start of the book. So Tim's saying he's just done a show with his dear friend Text, and I'd been approached by a woman who had asked me if I wanted to go home with her. I said no, but being asked home by an attractive German woman was a new and surprising experience, so I had to ask her, why me? Because you look like Sean Penn, she replied. I was intrigued. Did she mean The Falcon and the Snowman, Sean Penn, or Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Sean Penn, or, remembering my recent haircut and greased quiff, Dead Man Walking, Sean Penn? The post-show music took over in the room and her answer was lost to me. Then Tex grabbed me by the elbow and we spent the night doing Jim Morrison impressions to a bemused group of stragglers. We chose the Fat Poet Days, Jim, far, far funnier. Then in Dublin, a few years later, I was doing an interview for a small radio station on the afternoon of a solo show. The DJ knew a bit about my stuff and was generous, but once the tape stopped recording, he said, you know, Tim, I was going to come to the show tonight, but my wife thinks you look like Daniel Day-Lewis, and I know how much of a crush she has on him, so it's a no-show for us, I'm afraid. My left foot, Daniel? There Will Be Blood, Daniel? Or The Last of the Mohicans, Daniel? That very night, I told the DJ story to the little mob in Dublin and included previous comparisons to Ray Davies, Pete Townsend, at least two members of Jet, footy player John Mopsy Rantle, and a giraffe. Some I got, most I didn't, but I concluded with my story of the German penophile. That's penophile. From the back of the room, after an excited squeal, a woman's voice with a German accent bellowed, "That was me!" We spoke briefly afterwards through wry grins, but no further invitation was even hinted, which figures. Not having the patience to brood enigmatically, my countenance was arch but inquisitive, more like Pen Gillette. So that's a nice little excerpt from the book that relates to that tune, but once again, doesn't really enlighten me about what the song's about, but maybe that's just about that. But it's a great song that I think links the front and back of this album well, And a little side note, I was actually going out with a lovely someone at the time of dilettantes, which, you know, is miraculous in itself. And unsurprisingly, I tried to get her into UMI, and she played along, which was, you know, she was really great. And I think she even bought dilettantes to play in her car. And she was driving us somewhere one night, and we had the record on. And for some reason, in her car, you couldn't play track six. You couldn't play this track. It skipped straight from Wankers to The Boys and You're at the Water. And of course, I was outraged. I tried to explain that she was missing the true dilettante experience, and, you know, maybe she should check with the automotive manufacturer.
There needs to be a recall on the 2006 Corolla. This is outrageous.
I was thinking they might be ruining musical experiences all over the world, but she didn't really care. But, yeah, I love the sound of this tune. It's a cracking ending too. I don't know what pedal is on the guitar at the end, but it's a chef's kiss from me.
Yeah, I guess for this one, some songs you just wonder, like, in what context would I listen to this song? And especially when you kind of consider the way we listen to music now, where you can kind of create any type of playlist for yourself. You don't need to burn a CD or, you know, go to LimeWire or do all that nonsense. It's very easy to assemble a playlist of choice. And so I think if I was going to pick a playlist for this particular song, I would choose, for me, it's a pissed at 5:30 in the afternoon type of tune, where let's say you're going to go somewhere, you know, it's going to be, it's dinner and drinks at a friend's house, and you know, it's going to be a relatively early night, early start, early finish type of vibe. So you think, let's have a couple of drinks at home before we go. Then maybe two drinks turns into three drinks, four drinks turns into five. Before you know it, you and the missus, you're dancing like you're the Fonzie and some floozy at the milk bar in the, around the kitchen bar before you've even left the house. Yeah. And so for me, I think that kind of, it's fun. It's carefree. And it's a pissed at 5:30 in the afternoon type of tune for me.
And there is like an element of fun that we've discovered here. So at the start, when I recounted the first lyrics there, it was in a Hamburg nightclub, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a, you know, he's having a discussion with the woman, and there's like a nice little appearance by a woman character where she just goes, yeah, yeah, the fat man, the snowman, yeah. It's just like a cool little funny little bit for the train spotters, I reckon.
Yeah, I think that definitely, even though that there's some heavy themes on this album, it's a UMI album filled with Tim Rogers songs. It's going to be irreverent. So I feel like
humor, yeah.
The pockets of humor and the kind of like self-referential stuff, that's always going to be there. And I think that it perhaps shows kind of like a shifting that maybe began with Convicts and then kind of transitioned to these later records. I saw a Rogers interview with this Melbourne-based music, I believe his name is Raj Thomas or something, and he's like affiliated with the AFL community. He's got this little podcast thing where he interviews Melbourne celebs, and they play a board game at the same time. It's a nice little interview, I think, from a year or so ago with Tim. Okay. And he says, he asked Tim a question you must get a lot, is like, can you appreciate your own back catalog? And he said that he struggles to, because he said, we had a great bass player, we had an amazing drummer in the 90s, but we took ourselves very seriously. And I think when he says ourselves, he's talking about himself specifically, being very characteristically hard on himself. But I feel like with Convicts and then these later albums, they kind of maybe drop the pretense a little bit of like, and so therefore you get a bit more kind of like, these songs filled with personality. Do you know what I'm getting at here?
A bit more honesty, perhaps. Is that what you mean? Yeah.
Potentially, but just I feel like maybe it's just like a less pressure. You know, like the second half of Deliverance, where it was like, yeah, let's make this more like a Tim solo album. It's like the pressure has been kind of lifted, whereas I think the early albums, what made them great is that they were clearly putting a lot of pressure on themselves. And so I feel like that they kind of when it became apparent that they weren't going to like crack America or whatever, I think the pressure got lifted. Mm-hmm. And so therefore you've got more room to maneuver with these later albums. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but I'm just thankful that they've kind of like the pressure's come down, it seems, at least internally.
Yeah, totally agree. Yeah.
All right. Track 7, The Boys Angry at the Water. Another true story from Detours.
Yeah, that's right. So grandma used to say regularly regarding me, give that boy a tennis ball and you won't see him for weeks, just see. That's very evocative for me. I spent a lot of time with my grandparents as a kid and, you know, I loved it. But, you know, when you're a kid, you're easily bored. But hand me a tenno to chuck against the wall in order to take a series of classic catches. And I was occupied for hours just chucking it against the wall in the half volley and then diving the length of the backyard. There's just like some of the great memories. I think the neighbors of my grandparents sort of got over it after a while, but it didn't stop me. And also a beautiful exit. I don't know what it's called, like exit singing in this tune. What's that called when you kind of sing yourself out, you know, where it goes, hoist that mainsail and raise those eyelids past the dry land into the big drink. I don't know what that's called, but it becomes a feature of some songs, including like Tim Solo songs as well, where he kind of has a little, you know, couplet or a little chorus or verse or whatever that he sings the song out to, which I really like in this song as well. Is there a term for that?
Perhaps there is. None spring to mind. Yeah, I'm just thinking like outro. I'm thinking outro, like a basic pitch at the moment. I can't think of it. But I feel like this falls in the canon of the childhood tune, the What's the Deal, Jerry Seinfeld airplane food, but in a good way with Tim's fond memories of his youth, or not so fond sometimes. But either way, it's fun to time travel with Timmy. And once again, just a common gripe I have with lots of the record, I just feel there's something not quite right with the mix where I feel like the song is not where it could be. That's essentially that's my short and sweet takeaway from this one, where I feel like somewhat of a lost opportunity.
Happy with that.
So we're basically halfway through now. Track 8, Giving Up and Getting Fat.
Yeah, look, a lush but rockin' number, a real goer of a song. First of all, the film clip is a prequel to the Beau Jest film clip, and it's very funny. You know, think comical running in front of green screens. You know, how can you go wrong? In terms of what it's about, Tim does note in Detours that it's kind of about seeing the silver lining in aging and avoiding the obsessions of trying to stay young. Before reading that, I always took it as kind of taking pride in never taking the easy way out. You know, I could just give up, get fat, get the fucking romance, get the sweet slice of the deal. Maybe that's the same sort of thing. But it's a super, super tune. I love the call and response in the chorus. I love how it slips between gears. It is quite lush at times in between, like the chorus into the verse, but then it heads into overdrive for the chorus. So I think it's a cracker of a tune.
Yeah, big fan of this one. I think Tim's voice is better in the mix with this one, which makes it stand out for me. Agree with the kind of sentiment of the lyrics and all, you know, with the extra context of having read Detours. And massive drums from Rusty as we kind of launch into the chorus. And if I was gonna mini genre for this one, this is Drunk in the Airport song, where you may be lost in a bit of anger and regret and feeling a bit boozy from the airport lounge, but you're maintaining
still 2 hours before your next flight.
So there's you know, a lot of energy pumping through your mind, but you just seem like you're on the flat elevator thing. What's it called? This is worse than the divot thing for the amphitheater last week. What's it called? Where it's a
travelator or something.
The solo's massive. I'm punching randoms in the mosh pit at the end of this one, in my mind at least. I would never do that, but yeah, no, amazing track, and obvious kind of single pick. All right, track 9, Erasmus.
Yeah, really sweet song, you know, about a kid who I guess has enough self-awareness to know that he's a bit rough and a bit of an outsider and wants to prove everyone that he has a bit more to himself. But you also get the sense that he's kind of barking up the wrong tree about how to prove that he's proved people wrong. So you do love this kid because he's a real trier. Because I'm going to be more than I was just because is a nice sentiment. And you just hope that Erasmus, I guess it was the kid's name, can channel it all into the right direction. But yeah, another pearler from the point of view of a young'un. You know, Tim has never lost the feels of being a kid. Most people do forget, I reckon, or it kind of becomes a bit of a blur, but it's crystal clear to Tim. It remains crystal clear. Yeah, but a cool song. I think it was the first single off the album too.
Yeah, I've got a, you know, sweet memory of this song where they played it. It was a relatively short-lived AFL show when Channel 10 had that AFL rights. I think it was called Before the Game. Hellyer was involved. Limo, the comedian, was involved. And, maybe it was Hellyer that was responsible for the booking. I know he's a big UMI man, but UMI played this song live on that show. You know how studio performances can be very hit or miss because the mix can be off. But this particular set, the mix was dialed in. And what was cool is that Tim altered the lyrics to include everyone in the band's names. So I think in the actual song, he references his own name at the start. Tim wants, I forget the opening lyric, but then in this version when they performed it live, he then went to Davey and then Rusty and then Andy. And then at the end, it's a great moment. They look cool as shit. Tim's wearing a cravat, super rock and roll. Davey's like playing the guitar, but then also the organ in the verse part. And he does all the, and then when there's the kind of part towards the end where it's just the drums, and I think in the actual track here they have the female vocalist, the part.
That sounds lovely, she says when Erasmus says, and I'm in love with rock and roll, and she's like, that sounds lovely.
Exactly. But in the live version, Tim says North Melbourne's on the ball, so with the AFL theme, and then some other kind of like ad lib stuff. And then a big, I'm in love with rock and roll. And then he leans back from the mic and then lets off a huge fuck yeah on live TV, baby. So it still cuts through. And we've talked about this before. He knows how to drop an F-bomb pretty well with live shows. And I recommend checking it out. But always love this song because of the stellar live performance with lots of energy. Check that out on YouTube.
Yeah, I will. Definitely will.
Track 10, Davey's Gone Green Again. For me, I'll let you jump in, but for me, I've got a one-sentence explanation. This is, for me, this is the explaining cricket of this record. This is how I see this one.
Yeah. It's kind of like a sweet, fun corner of the record in a similar way that Convicts had that kind of weird corner of the record towards Explaining Cricket and Constance George. But yeah, this tune kind of really makes me laugh. I think it shows the strength of Tim and Davey's relationship. You know, Tim can write a song and poke gentle fun at Davey, who's, you know, happy to play the role of Davey in a bit of a wide-eyed and hapless but sweet kind of way. And I love Davey's vocal interjections, like when Tim suggests that Davey might have purple fever. You're joking, he kind of says in the background. So before Davey joined the band, Tim asked permission of Davey's mum for him to join the band. And because Davey was young, I think he was 18 or 19 or something. And I reckon that played on Tim's mind for a while, you know, that responsibility, or even like, am I living up to this kid's dreams? If you know what I mean? Because Davey was just like a super fan. But now, of course, it's all worked out beautifully. I mean, look at Davey now. But here I want to call out also Davey's solo, which I would say is perfection. it starts by sounding hungover, which is appropriate to the song. And then maybe there's a bit of like hair of the dog action and it just sort of bursts into action. It also takes you on tour with Davey after a big night. Is he going to be able to make it to the gig tonight? Is he going to be able to get himself together for tonight's gig? You know, of course he is. You know, often when you're badly hungover, you don't know if you can function. And then there's just a turning point. It might be a beer. It might be a bacon and egg roll or a greasy rissole. But it's like the flick of the switch. You're back. And that's what happens in the solo as well. So the solo kind of reflects the song beautifully.
Yeah, definitely a pocket of irreverence once again. And I recall that story. It's a sweet story with like asking Davey's parents permission. And I'm not sure if you remember, their response was pretty cute as well. They were like, look at him. What else is he going to do? They were like basically telling Tim to relax. Like, yeah, he can join your band. Go have fun. So, nice little fun track towards the end of the record. Track 11, Jolly's First Time Around the Sun. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the theme of this song comes from Tim's dad, who unfortunately passed away last year, I think. So I remember hearing Tim tell a story about when he was a kid, he got into trouble at school or something and his dad came to pick him up and Tim thought, you know, I'm just going to get a bollocking here. And then Tim's dad kind of went all silent and it kind of drove Tim mad. And from memory, he kind of asked his dad, you know, can you just be angry and sort of get it over with? And his dad said something to the effect of, look, Timmy, this is my first time around for this stuff. I'm doing my best. I guess kind of a light bulb moment where you realize, oh, yeah, my folks are not the sort of all-knowing beings I thought they were. They have doubts too. They're kind of making it up too. And I think he takes this concept and is thinking about, you know, his own experiences of fatherhood. You know, near the end of the song, he sings, you know, if you look, you can find your old man there by your side. He'll get it wrong. He will learn yet. It's just his first time around. You know, absolute goosebumps for me, this tune, especially like the second half of it. But also the intro guitar chord progression or whatever you call that riff, I think is beautiful as well. I'm not sure if it's a 12 string or something, but for me, in my mind, it's Tim playing that. It sounds a bit more Tim than Davey, but it's a lovely little intro guitar progression. So I just really love this song.
Yeah, I'm a big fan as well. You know, for me, many of us like to make up little mini narratives within albums and hypothetical characters that appear in some songs. Do they reappear in others? And so for me, what I mentioned before, I think that Disappearing is kind of like a trucker song at the beginning of the day in a small Australian country town. I like to think that this one is kind of like the same characters reappearing for kind of like a piss up in a paddock. It's kind of like all stages of life, people, early fatherhood, later fatherhood, giving your daughter away type of stuff, those big moments and all that stuff. I really like this one, and the way it kind of the crescendo, I think, works really well in this one. Whereas we mentioned before, earlier tracks where you want it to explode or it maybe plods along, whereas this one, I feel like it actually does have some type of strong crescendo that it has like a payoff. That's the poppier part of your brain maybe wants when you listen to a pop rock album or adult alternative album. I'm a big fan of this one. One of my faves from the record.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, you tell me as a young father, how, you know, certain things are thrown at you where you're like, I've got no idea how to handle this, or I've got no idea what to do now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there are stuff that you can kind of glean from your own experience as a kid and watching other people be fathers, and then certain things happening like, oh shit, what do I do now? Is that kind of something that comes up or?
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think that with, just the whole challenge of it is that you, just as you feel like you're getting on top of a certain stage, like when they're learning how to burp him, you don't need to burp him anymore. You got to figure out how to baby-proof a room for a toddler. It's like just as you're getting on top of stuff, then it changes. So, there's definitely a fish out of water feeling that I can relate to here. But also kind of like the way I approach it is if you understand, you're like, look, I'm not going to be perfect. Yeah. I'm going to mess my kid up in certain ways because that's inevitable. I just want to make sure they're not in the obvious ways where they're going to be a surprise. Ways that I know I have faults, and as long as I do my best to curb my enthusiasm with those faults, then you're doing your best. So
And I think that's the vibe in this song as well. So we're talking about, like, you know, the dark and gloominess of the album at the start, but there are pockets, I think, we've found of fun stuff, and there's a bit of like understanding and hope in this song, and I think maybe the last song as well, as we get into the piano up the tree. I kind of see this last song as like a bit of a flip side, you know, maybe a reaction to Disappearing, track two, which is, as we said, it's pretty dark. But here, he's not going to cross that line and disappear off the face of the earth. He's going to, you know, back it on up and start again. He's not giving up. So I think, you know, this end to the album provides hope. And it's quite, this song, I think, is quite inspirational in a way. Like when you're having that tough time and you're like, no, I'm going to keep going. I'm going to start again if I have to. And seeing it live during this period kind of helped me understand the power of this particular song, the piano up the tree, the final track. I kind of jumped in there, but I just thought there was a nice ending to the album that kind of is a counterpoint to the start of the album, which is kind of dark and sad, whereas this end, you know, it maintains that sadness, but it also has hope and looks on, I guess, the brighter side of things, and you kind of come out of the album feeling like you've been through the ringer emotionally. You started pretty low and you've kind of gone through various things, but by the end your heart kind of have a bit of sunshine in you and a bit of hope and a bit of optimism, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, it's funny you mention all that stuff, because it kind of, I had lots of similar notes here, and I guess a similar song, just in terms of the kind of similar themes, and obviously being a last track, was that sprung to mind was the last track on Deliverance, When You Know What You Want. And when we did that episode, I mentioned to you that I felt like, and I could be clutching at straws here, but that it was written from the opposite perspective of someone who doesn't know what they want, is feeling a bit lost. But that kind of gives it's kind of like a plea rather than like a someone reflection. Sharing like, actual wisdom. And so for this one, I don't think it works as well as that particular track, because, it's obviously got the optimistic takeaway of kind of like things are shit, but you can kind of pull yourselves up. You can make it, what's the line? You don't want your anger to define any possible good you've got inside. Just back it on up and start again. I don't know whether it's just because the rest of the album, well, the beginning of the album, let's say, is not in, but for me this comes across as someone telling you something when they're drunk, and you're like, do you actually believe that, or are you drunk? if you know what I mean, and so for me it comes across as a little bit fake. I don't know if that's the right word, but I guess I don't, because I wanted to buy into the optimistic end and the kind of like, things are rough, but things can, we can be moving on up out of here. But for some reason I didn't buy it as much as I've done on other tracks, and I'm not sure if that's because there's like a weird Hall of Mirrors type of thing going on, where it's like, well, let's sing about something, but actually the emotion being on the opposite realm once again, or just because it doesn't align with what I've heard on prior tracks, but for some reason I kind of don't really, I don't buy the fact that someone's actually getting out of the hole they've dug for themselves. So that was my thoughts.
No, that's interesting. I guess you'd be unsurprised to hear that I did buy it. And I guess
and
we're
on the t-shirt.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess I do buy it because I'm just reflecting on, you know, decades of listening to Tim, I guess, in interviews and stuff and through his music and obviously reading his book, where obviously he has, you know, a whole bunch of issues that he's been trying to work through over the decades. But he does have an element to him where he's determined to try and make the best of it, or look at the bright side, or to get some sort of gratitude for what's come his way, even though he's having a tough time. And yeah, maybe at times it's just lip service to himself, you know, because he knows he might not be feeling it at the time, but he knows that he can get that feeling and he can get there. And so I think maybe that's what you're touching on a little bit, where he doesn't believe it quite yet, but he knows he has it in him. And so he's going to sing it until he does. And I think, you know, reading his book and knowing where he's got to now, I don't know where he is right now, but he seems to be in okay space. So maybe that's the way he approaches things, where, you know, if he's having a tough time, he knows he can make it to the other side, but he's just got to have a bit of patience and kind of do the right things, you know, mentally and emotionally, I guess, to get there. And when he gets there, he can sort of reflect and go, yeah, okay, I'm feeling good. And this is why I'm feeling good, because I was able to kind of weather the storm and get to the other side.
Yeah, no, I think all great points. And really, maybe this song it's perhaps kind of a litmus test for your ability to handle earnestness. You know, like I think I struggle with it. Maybe it's like the old toxic masculinity stuff, where it's like I would prefer to be exploring dark themes through the lens of fun and frivolity, like the Wolf of Wall Street, Trainspotting, as opposed to Requiem for a Dream. So when someone gets up and honestly says something, maybe my alarm goes off, where it's like, oh, emotion, avoid, you know, you might feel something yourself. So I definitely think there's something in it there where it's like, oh yeah, I feel like the emotion's a little too raw. And just purely for someone as maybe walled off emotionally as I am to buy into that, because I just know that it would be like, yeah, I would struggle to do that in any way, shape or form. But yeah, definitely. The point you raised in terms of like maybe him not believing it fully yet, but understanding the power of like putting it out there and then I guess chasing after that. That's potentially what's going on there.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be. I guess for me, I get the earnestness thing. I have that as well, like a bit of a, ooh, that's I know I've got a friend actually who maybe is a bit like you, who it just doesn't do earnest. And I've got another friend who is earnest, and watching them interact together, like my earnest friend will sort of just pour his heart out, and my other friend just looks at him blankly and has no idea how to react, and just go to the bar and get a beer and just give like the earnest friend's looking for something in return. And the non-earnest friend just like blanks him. It's just an interesting, very interesting situation.
Yeah. No, but I guess that's the thing, is that sometimes you want, power of music is that it can kind of like, even someone walled off like myself, you want it to trick you into saying, come along with me, here we go. And yeah, and so I think that if you have to overthink it and you have to really try and it's obviously not getting me there, but I can totally understand how someone else would kind of would see
Yeah.
I'm just going to stop talking. You know what I mean.
I do know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah. All right. And, well, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say this album, I think my homework for the week will be to try work out a different sequencing of the album to see if that changes my reception of the album, which, you know, I absolutely love and I think is right up there with their best, to be honest. Because, yeah, maybe not to change my reception but to change your reception or other people who haven't quite grasped Dilettantes because of the way the feel you get in the first couple of songs and then it tries to sort of ramp up and then that'll be my homework for the week, but I may not do that homework. All right, let's just put that out there, but in my mind that's what I'm going
to
do.
If I was a teacher, I'd never expect anyone to do homework, so you've assigned it yourself, so it's not due, but if you want to do it, go ahead. We'll definitely chat about it, because maybe it would have certain songs would have more punch if they were a bit earlier, and something I forgot to mention at the very beginning, and this will kind of tie into what we talk about in the outro, but songwriter Tim Rogers said of the album, "I think I'm as proud of that as I am of anything we've ever done." So that was from Wikipedia. I'm not sure when it was, when he said that, or to whom, but he was obviously proud of it at some point in time. And I don't know. I think that there is, when you put out a ton of work for the general public, there was like this, there was this joke on the Comedy Central roast of James Franco many years ago where I think it was Natasha Leggero made fun of James Franco. She said, "Franco, you're a lot like George Clooney in that he'll do one commercial film and then one art house independent film that he directs or produces. So one for them, one for me. Whereas you, James Franco, will do one for them and then six for no one." And so so I think that if you're an established creator, you at a certain point get to decide, well, this one is maybe for us, or that we want to go in this direction for whatever reason. It's like an exploration. It's an experiment. And as a fan of music in general, I'd rather an artist take chances and do something different, even if I'm personally not going to vibe with that album as much as I would with some other stuff, in the hope that that's going to like open up something for the future records or whatever. So
I do see
that's how I see these type of albums. First of all, I'm getting lots of good songs that I still like and some interesting pockets here or there, and they're probably just victims of like having really great albums that I'm understandably comparing it to as well. So that's tough.
And I think I do kind of see Dilettantes as more of a piece of art compared to other records, like, you know, Convicts or the other records that are a bit more direct. Whereas the way I approach Convicts is like, okay, I'm approaching it, this is a bit more of a piece of art, so I'm going to try to kind of appreciate it as if I'm going into, you know, you go into a gallery and you're like, okay, this is not what I'm used to, but I'll give it a go and I'll kind of look at it from a different lens. So that's how I kind of approach Dilettantes, because it's not as direct and immediate as other albums. That's kind of how I approach it, and for me that kind of works. But I do note that you mentioned also, and I want to ask you, Tommy, that Greg Wales, I said at the top, he won an ARIA Award, according to Wiki, for being Engineer of the Year for Dilettantes. What is an engineer in the musical sense? If I did engineering at uni and did my apprenticeship working on Snowy 2.0, could I transition easily to a music studio? Is that the same thing, or is it just like someone who, you know, makes it sound okay?
Yeah, my understanding is that like you've got the producer who is kind of like the creative director, who's like, okay, yeah, have you considered extending that verse by twice, or like what happens if this song was acoustic, kind of like big picture decisions, whereas the engineer is more like, we need more crunch on the second guitar. Yes. So I think it's literally, I think this, like from the Beatles, had George R. Martin, and then they had like, he had producers under them who'd help them get to their desired sound with the respective instruments. So that's my understanding of it, at least. And I'm guessing it would be a collaborative effort with the mix with both the engineer and the producer. But yeah, as far as I understand, the engineer is like how each of the parts sound.
Yeah, cool. That makes sense.
So yeah, anything to add in terms of what's happening with the band post album, or should we just get into the bronze, silver, gold?
Yeah, no, I think I'm ready for the bronze, silver, gold. I don't have much to add for the album. So this one heads into the self-titled album next time around. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of transitions into that. But yeah, don't have much to add beyond that.
All right, cool. Well, yeah, why don't I? I'll go first so we can save Jono's. Sure. So my bronze would be Jolly's First Time Around the Sun. Erasmus just missed out making the podium. So my silver would be giving up and getting fat. And my gold was my favorite back in the day. It's still my favorite today. Bjørgeste. Still don't know how to say it, but still my fave. Schweppes, please don't sue the boys. Jono, what's your podium?
Yeah, my podium is bronze, dilettantes. Silver, I'm going Davey's Gone Green again. I really have so much fun with that track. And gold, Jolly's First Time Around the Sun.
Nice. So well, we had a little crossover this week.
Yeah, there you go.
First time in a while.
Yeah, good album. And look, Tommy, before we wrap up, should we mention that we've had a bit of feedback on the pod over the last little while. Holy moly. That's a turn up in the books.
Yeah, frothing. So yeah, let's give Avan Kumar, I believe, is the gentleman's name, who's came across us on YouTube, where you can find all the episodes of this podcast. And Arvin, I think that's how you probably say it, he chimed in with his gold, silver, bronze. And so it didn't really occur to me. I think that's a good way to get a bit of the old audience interaction here, is that why don't go to YouTube, listen to the episodes, and then drop your own gold, silver, bronze, because, yeah, I'd be intrigued to see what other people are picking. And yeah, or you can just shit on our choices, whatever you prefer, really. Appreciate the feedback.
Yeah, thanks, Arvin. And I got to say, when I first saw the message from Arvin, he said, you know, great show, I really enjoy the track by track analysis. And then he referenced something that I think I said in the Dress Me Slowly episode. He said, Super Ted rules. And yes, I agree. But when I first saw those words written, I thought it said, like, for a split second, I thought it said Super Ted Cruz. And in my mind, for a split second, I'm like, oh no, what's happened? But no, Super Ted rules. But like, reading those words, kind of like there is some kind of crossover there. I was like, oh no, what have we done? But no, Arvin said Super Ted rules, not Super Ted Cruz. There you go.
Yeah. Well, so there is all the apps there, and if you want to get in touch via email, there's the email address in the episode description, and there's also the Twitter account, which Jono's handling.
If you want to join the most pathetic attempt at community building, then join the Twitter community, because there's an underscore in there. You know, do your best, but yeah, maybe click on the link in the episode notes.
Yeah, it's joining Twitter at this time, it feels like you're just lending a hand for the right-wing community. All the lefties are bailing on Twitter, all the righties are coming back on board, so who knows where it's all at. But anyway, you can find all those links in the episode notes. Stay tuned for next week. We'll be going through number 9, UMI record, the self-titled. Jono, it's been a blast.
Yeah, likewise, mate. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.